It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this week all of us, public radio listeners and producers, were shocked and saddened by the death of NPR photojournalist David Gilkey. He and his translator were killed while they were on assignment in Afghanistan when the convoy they were traveling in was ambushed by the Taliban. Photojournalists like David go places most of us wouldn't want to go. They take pictures of things we may not even want to see. They risk their lives, hoping to send back that one image that just might change someone's mind or open someone's heart. I heard David Gilkey talk a couple of years ago. This was on a panel with some other public radio journalists, and he told a story I've never forgotten. He'd just gotten back from Liberia, where he was covering the Ebola epidemic, and he told us about a single photo he took. It was a picture of a little boy who looks like he's 4 or 5 years old.
Well, this is a little boy saw EXCO. We first came across him on a beach in Monrovia, sitting naked, scared on a little bucket. He was sitting on a paint bucket, surrounded by about 50 people. And he was clearly sick. He couldn't move. I shot video of him in the morning, and then as the day progressed, we left and we came back, and somebody had moved him about, I don't know, 20 yards up to where this photograph is, or the photograph was taken, and no one would touch him. Nobody was helping the situation. Myself and another photographer, John Moore, had latex gloves. We gave them to the locals. We just sort of stood around and asked what they were going to do about it. And, you know, it was heartbreaking because the locals in this area were, you know, denying for the most part that Ebola existed, yet nobody would touch the little boy. Eventually, we went back the next morning. He was gone. Somebody had taken him to the hospital overnight, I think by taxi. It was all a little murky. And that afternoon we learned that he had died. So it was a tremendously difficult thing to watch because you were seeing the real sort of face of Ebola and how lonely it could be. Look, the situation that unfolded, at least for me in Liberia that day, was something that I think anybody would reach out to do something. I mean, I think we all, in journalism 101 and 102 and 3, you know, learned, oh, you're not part of the scene, you're not, you know, you have to take a step back. And this was a situation that, as on a human level, you had to do something. I mean, look, there was also just the fine line of being safe. So I couldn't pick the little boy up and take him myself to the hospital. That would be, I think, too much, and it would be putting myself at risk. But on the same token, certainly I had latex gloves. We had the ability to do a little something for the situation that was there. And if that, I don't know if that's right or wrong, but it certainly made me feel about a little bit better about what I was taking pictures of.
You talked about this photograph on All Things Considered. And then NPR received a letter from listeners who heard about. There's a couple in Southern California. And I want to read this letter, if that's okay. My wife is 7 weeks pregnant, and after hearing David Gilkey's story about Sa Exco, that's the little boy's name, I knew that we had found the name for our child. When Sa Exco passed away, no one was able to give him love, care, and protection. And in honor of Sa Exco, my wife and I are going to name our first child after him and provide it with what Sa was missing so very much in the last few days of his life. How have you ever gotten a letter like that before? And how did you, I don't know, how did you react when you heard it?
I mean, I was overwhelmed. You know, I don't personally want to take credit for anything. I mean, that's not why we do what we do, but getting a letter like that is why we sort of take the risk sometimes that we do, and why we get out there, and to actually hear from somebody who was so affected by not only the story, but the photograph and sort of the stuff that we did online around it and the social media of getting it out there. I mean, it's just a rare opportunity to where you get to feel the effects of what you're doing.
That was photojournalist David Gilkey. We say goodbye to him and his translator. They were killed this week while on assignment in Afghanistan. The world is a poorer place without them. Great war photographers bring a tremendous sense of mission to their work. Most of them believe that the right image, seen by enough people at the right time, can maybe change the world. Not right away, but in time. Over the past 30 years, the photographer James Noctway has covered just about every major armed conflict in the world. He's been shot and wounded more than once, and he's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize 10 times. I talked with him when he had just put together an exhibition of photos that he took in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the place those wars began, Ground Zero on 9/11.
I lived not far from it. I could see it from my window. When I saw the first tower smoking, I thought it was an accident, but an accident of that magnitude at the World Trade Center was obviously going to be very important, so I began to assemble my camera gear. While I was doing that, there was a kind of vibration in the air, and my windows rattled, and I looked out my window again, saw that the second tower was burning, and understood immediately that we'd been attacked, and the United States was now at war.
And what did you do? You went out into the street, and as everybody was running away, you started running toward the scene?
Well, that's what I do, exactly. That would be part of my job description. I got there before either of the towers fell, and I was framing both towers burning when the South Tower collapsed. And there's a picture in the show that depicts that moment.
Yeah, let's talk about that one. There are no people in that photograph, but it's kind of terrifying. I mean, you should describe it.
It was, hard to believe. I was seeing it with my own eyes. Those steel girders that you see flying through the air like matchsticks are huge. I don't know how many hundreds, if not thousands of pounds each. Gigantic pieces of metal and sides of the building were flying through the air, as well as a kind of confetti of tens of thousands of pieces of paper that had been inside filing cabinets. Somehow my mind literally clicked into slow motion, and all of this was just floating towards me so slowly I thought I had all the time in the world to make the frame, and only I was shooting film. There were 36 frames on a roll of film as opposed to digital, which has many more. Mm. I got to the last frame when I shot that picture, and that stopped me because I knew I had to change film. And in stopping me, everything went back into normal motion, and I realized I was about to get taken out. And I had a few seconds to take cover in the lee of buildings on the other side of the street from where I was standing, and all of the wreckage sort of fell over me. As a photographer, my job is to document visually, and that's what I did. But it's still hard to believe. I looked at the picture yesterday, and it was hard to believe. I've actually never gotten over it.
I've read some of the things you said about why you chose to become a photojournalist in the first place. I think it goes way back to you were a student in the 1960s. Vietnam War was happening, civil rights protests, and the photographs taken at the time you felt really changed history.
Photographers were telling us one thing, and our political and military leaders were telling us something else. And I found the work of the photographers to be more convincing. And when I finally decided what I wanted to do with my life, that's what I decided I wanted to do. I wanted to be part of that tradition. I saw that pictures could not only record history, in some way they help change the course of history. They become an element in the process of change.
So the role of the war photographer is a crucial one to a democracy, I guess.
I think it's absolutely necessary. I think that the stories we tell are vital for society to function properly. How can citizens make proper decisions unless they know what's going on? Journalism is vital, and I think the particular role that photography plays is that it can make a human connection, help people see something that is universal, that transcends culture, that transcends nationality, religion, race, and is just simply human. You're witnessing something that's happening to an individual.
You're making me think about another photo in this exhibition. It's one of an Afghan woman, I think. She's completely covered in a burqa, and she's kneeling on the ground in a graveyard. You can't even see her face, but the grief is just palpable. Where was that taken? Who is she?
It was taken in a cemetery in Kabul in 1996, and she was there mourning her brother who'd been killed in a Taliban rocket attack. At that time, the Taliban had surrounded Kabul and were shelling and rocketing daily. I think the graveyard itself is expressive. It's so humble, bare, cracked earth with uncarved kind of raw stone. And her hand, her aged, weathered hand that had seen a hard life, reaching out, touching the stone, as if that's as close as she could get to her brother. What you don't get from the picture is the sound she was making as she was grieving for her brother. She was singing a kind of song in this very grief-stricken voice. It was very moving.
How do you deal with being in the places you've been, seeing the kind of suffering you've seen? I imagine one way of dealing with it would be to wall it off when you're working, to just suppress your own reactions until later. But I'm wondering whether that's changed a bit for you over the years. I mean, whether you found ways to either to open up a bit more, to actually work with and use your emotions, or do they just get in the way?
No, the emotions are natural. You have to channel them. You have to use them. You have to channel them into the work. If I were to see things and not feel emotions, then I wouldn't make pictures that were worth much. I'm the one who has to feel it first if I'm going to make anyone else feel something. So it's never been the case, and it's simply not the case that photographers go someplace and wall themselves off. Our job is actually quite the opposite. Our job is to go someplace and open ourselves up and leave ourselves vulnerable and feel those things and put it into our work so that we can translate it and pass it on to the viewers.
I'm just thinking about how hard it must be for you. I don't know, what do you do with the grief?
You carry it with you. Nothing is forgotten. And I guess you have to carry it with you with as much grace as you possibly can. You know, again, as opposed to the stereotype, rather than getting hardened to it, I find that I get more and more sensitized to it, and it gets actually more difficult to witness such things, not less difficult. And it's just something you have to bear.
Hmm. I mean, you've been shot. Weren't you injured in a grenade attack?
I'd been covering a single platoon for Time magazine, and I was with Mike Weisskopf, a Time reporter, and a grenade was thrown into the Humvee, and Mike had his hand blown off, and I got injured with shrapnel, and a couple of the soldiers got pretty badly hurt.
Were you still taking photographs while you were injured?
Until I passed out, yes.
Wow. Why do you keep going back?
I have a lot of experience. I still see that there's a reason as much as ever to do it. And I guess I do it because I can.
That's James Noctway. He's one of the world's great war photographers and also the recipient of the Dresden International Peace Prize. If you want to see that iconic photo from Ground Zero, it's on our website at ttbook.org. I'm Anne Strangechamps, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from Organic Valley, a co-op of family farms bringing organic food to family tables. Founded in 1988, Organic Valley believes in producing food in a way that respects the earth, animals, and future generations. OrganicValley.com.
There are moral and ethical issues that come up a lot around war photography. The late philosopher Susan Sontag wrote famously about that, and we'll be revisiting our conversation with her a little bit later. But more recently, writer David Shields charged the New York Times with glamorizing war in photographs. Shields analyzed hundreds of pictures published on the front page of the Times, and last year he wrote a book accusing the paper of making war beautiful. Charles Monroe Kane sat down to talk with him.
War is Beautiful is the title of your book. Talk about provocative.
Right.
And these photos, you know, I was like, okay, I get your argument, blah, blah, blah. I got your book. Oh, my God. They are beautiful. Like, they're really beautiful. Yeah, they could be hanging in a museum. What's wrong with that? What are you getting at with that?
For 20 years, from the first Gulf War until through 2013, I would be struck by at least a couple times a week and sometimes several times a week, I'd be struck by pictures of war that sort of fed my war porn addiction. You know, it was really, these pictures were surpassingly beautiful. They were basically war as, what would you call them, kind of 20th century modernist masterpieces. Picture after picture, photo after photo seemed to me to be virtually appropriating Jackson Pollock, Mark Rothko, Jasper Johns, Richard Diebenkorn. I mean, it was just stunning to me how much of the war had been abstracted away from any kind of raw, naked, visceral horror. And it seems to me that these pictures function to disseminate a certain kind of ideology subtextually, namely that we sort of tell ourselves as readers of the paper that we're informed and somehow semi-concerned citizens and that we have properly bleeding hearts. But in reality, these pictures keep the war at, you might say, psychic arm's length, which to me enables the war to be fought and for consent to be manufactured. They're really important pictures in my view.
Okay, you know, I look through them and I was struck by two things. One, that they really weren't as graphic as I thought they were going to be. And two, that they're still very powerful. What do you want? Do you want more carnage? What do you want us to see?
You know, General Sherman said war is hell, and these pictures portray war as a sort of very pretty heck. On the one hand, you could say, what's the problem? You know, so what? You know, the Times runs 365 pictures every year, but I looked at literally 9,000 front pages of the New York Times, and we found 1,000 color war photos, and of those 1,000, 700 fulfilled my criterion of pictures that, in my view, aestheticized horror. And I found precious few examples that, to me, in my view, conveyed the raw horror. So you could say, you know, what's the harm? But I guess the book is trying to argue that what subcurrent is running underneath that picture? Is there an irreducible glamour? Where is the horror? Where is the cost?
Is that policy or just happening kind of on accident?
I think that's the $64,000 question. I mean, this book is not an investigative book in the sense that I've uncovered 47 internal memos at the New York Times in which Dick Cheney and John Kerry have sent memos to the New York Times, and they said, if you ever print a picture of a dead soldier, that you will be denied access to the higher levels of government. You know, I don't have any such proverbial smoking gun. And I think it's an open question as to what's happening. Have all these photographers simply gone to school on the Western pictorial tradition and they can't help but take pictures of war as romance, as glamour, as beauty, as glory? Have the photo editors gone to school on the same tropes?
You know, our country has been at war now for 14 years. There's a lot of images from those wars that we've seen, just still images. Have they seduced us?
To me, these pictures are effective seduction, because if these pictures appeared on the front page of the Wall Street Journal or USA Today or the New York Daily News, there's no story, because people understand those papers to be rightward-leaning, military-leaning, whose agenda is quite clear. But the Times' brand is weirdly a kind of quasi-neutrality. And I think seduction is particularly problematic when we don't know the agenda of the seducer. And I even feel somewhat complicit. I wish I had gotten this book done 10 years earlier. It definitely took me too long to realize what was happening and too long to produce the book. So I'm proud of the book. I think it makes a relatively good case, but I felt seduced for too long, and this book is an attempt to, you know, break that seduction.
The book is called War is Beautiful, by writer David Shields. Charles Monroe Cain talked with him. And if you want to see some of those pictures, visit our website at ttbook.org. We're talking about the impact of photojournalism today. And, you know, it's hardly original to say that we live in an increasingly visual culture. Anyone who works in news will tell you that photographs drive attention, that a great photo can propel a story or an issue from the sidelines to the center of public conversation. Large-scale photographer Edward Bertinsky is making it his life's work to jumpstart a global conversation about sustainability by photographing scarred, damaged industrial landscapes. He's a TED Prize winner, and his work is in more than 50 museum collections. Bertinsky and filmmaker Jennifer Bikewell have been working together on two documentaries. Steve Paulson talked with her about their first, filmed in China. It's called Manufactured Landscapes.
These photographs presuppose the ideal of a pristine landscape. They're kind of like the fallen world in a way. There aren't many places left in the world where you can experience pristine landscape. And when you think about how difficult it is to photograph that kind of landscape without falling into all kinds of cliches, you know, how do you do a photograph of pristine nature that is compelling and doesn't feel like you're looking at a calendar? His work certainly, I think, presupposes the fact that this landscape once existed, and we are changing a lot of the shape of the earth, of the planet, by the way that we live.
Well, it's fascinating to hear you say that. It's almost as if he has taken the old style that Ansel Adams used to do. You know, he'd go out west and do these magnificent photographs of great natural wonders, but Ed Bertinsky has done that of fantastic manufactured scenes.
Exactly. And sometimes, I mean, I've been in these landscapes with him in these contexts, and it's not easy to see the beauty there. I mean, when you see the photographs, they're stunningly beautiful. They're aesthetically very compelling, which is part of the paradox of the work, because you're looking at something that has, you know, swirls of color and is incredibly intriguing aesthetically. And when you get in closer, you realize that you're looking at garbage. You're looking at densified oil filters or, you know, billions of little electronic parts in a pile of e-waste. And then you kind of recoil at the content. And something about that that reaction allows you, I think, to meditate on your own impact on the planet, what you do to the world by living in it, and the cycles of consumption and waste that we all sometimes incredibly unconsciously engage in.
I had a bit of an epiphany being lost in Pennsylvania, and I took a left turn trying to get back to the highway, and I ended up in a town called Frackville. And I got out of the car and I stood up, and it was a coal mining town, and I did a 360 turnaround, and that became one of the most surreal landscapes I'd ever seen, totally transformed by man. And that got me to go out and look at the largest industrial incursions that I could find. And that became the baseline of what I was doing.
Well, I was especially struck by some of the scenes of, I guess, what is called e-waste, recycled computers, and a huge percentage of recycled computers from around the world end up in China in these huge dumps, and they are compressed, and they are beautiful in your film and in his photographs. I mean, to me, they look like modern art, right? Sort of this kind of compressed metallic sculpture that could be hanging in a museum somewhere.
And yet, the reality of that e-waste, it is true that 50% of the world's e-waste gets shipped to China, perhaps more, but it is technically illegal there, recycling e-waste. So it's this huge underground cottage industry, and you have whole small villages and towns that are devoted to e-waste recycling, with people sitting on their porches breaking apart computers and monitors, and of course all of the toxic metals that are used in the process of making these things simply leach into the groundwater and into the ground, to the point where in some places the water is so contaminated they have to have water shipped in. So there's this huge problem with how we deal with things after we throw them away. And there's something about these photographs that allow you to witness the places that you are responsible for but would never normally see. And I think once you see these places, once you are in these places, it's impossible not to have your consciousness changed.
At one point I was shooting a mine, and it was a silver mine.
Okay, it's a little dark.
I arrive in my car, made out of iron, you know, filled with gas. I pull out a metal tripod and grab film that's loaded with silver and start taking pictures. So everything that I'm doing is connected to the thing I'm photographing. Looking at these ships, the connection was clear. At some point, I probably filled a tank of gas from the oil that was delivered by one of these tankers.
Why did Ed Bertinsky go all the way to China to take these photographs? I mean, presumably he could have found these kinds of manufactured landscapes in other places as well.
Well, it's interesting because when he thought about, you know, what happens when I throw this computer away, what happens to it? So he followed his computer to China. It was e-waste that started him there, just like the shipbreaking series that he did in Bangladesh came out of a thought of what happens, you know, I fill up my car with a tank of gas in my car from oil that has been shipped from a tanker somewhere. What happens to those tankers when they die? And he's recognizing that there are places in the world where these things go that nobody gets to see. And he started in China because of e-waste, but also, you know, perhaps the biggest industrial revolution in history is happening in China at the moment. And the scale of it is so much bigger than anything that has gone on before.
Can you give me some sense of that scale in China? Just how big are some of these industrial productions?
Well, I mean, when you think about it, like, this is happening so rapidly. It's happening rapidly, and it's happening on a massive scale in China. So, for example, there's a place called the Yuyang Shoe Factory that has 90,000 workers, essentially.
90,000 you know, workers in one factory?
There's a shift change three times a day. It runs 24 hours a day, so 30,000 workers change hands three times a day in shifts. And they make more shoes than any other factory in the world. What's tragic about these places is that So far, and there's no question that China knows exactly what's going on here and is trying to deal with it, but there are no real environmental regulations in these factories. That's why they're there in China and not here in North America. You can pay people less, there's lots of labor, cheap labor, and there are no environmental regulations. So all the dyes and glues and the things that are used to make these things just go right out into the waterways. And it's coming to a real crisis because of that fact. And so it's not like China doesn't know what they're doing. They're doing what every other industrialized country has done, which is, you know, industrialize now, make money, get dirty, clean up later. But they just may not have the luxury of making the same mistakes as other industrialized countries because the scale is so big. And there are already people there like Pan Yu, who is the deputy minister of the environment, who is very aware of the environmental catastrophes that China faces because of this rapid industrialization. And because essentially, you know, every dirty industry from around the world has set up shop there in the last, whatever, 20 years.
Well, how do you approach the ethics of the subject that you've taken on? Because on the one hand, you are putting forward some very beautiful images. And yet, as you say, the environmental consequences are disastrous. I mean, how do you square those two things?
Well, you know, I consider myself to be a fairly environmentally aware person. And I do think that existing environmental discourses, certainly in the 1970s and 80s and 90s, I suppose, failed to move people because they were too polarizing and didactic. So there were very much this sort of us and them mentality where if you did not live in the country and become an organic farmer and make your own clothes, you were doomed, you know, ethically to failure because you were participating in an urban life or you were driving a car or anything like that or buying clothes made halfway around the world. And I think that because they were so radical, they fail to move ordinary people to change their lives. And there's something about the way that Bertinsky's photographs work, which is an invitation to witness rather than a didactic argument, an invitation to experientially feel what these places are like and then to meditate on your own place in all of this, that I think is an alternative way of shifting consciousness. And I certainly felt like that when I first saw these photographs, which is probably the main reason why I wanted to make this film. And I wanted the film to do what the photographs do, which is profoundly shift consciousness, environmental consciousness, but in a completely non-didactic way.
There are times when I have thought about my work and putting it into a more politicized environment. If I said, this is a terrible thing that we're doing to the planet, then people will either agree or disagree. By not saying what you should see, that may allow them to look at something that they never looked at and to see their world a little differently. So I think many people today sit in that uncomfortable spot where, you know, we don't necessarily want to give up what we have, but we realize what we're doing is creating problems that run deep. It's not a simple right or wrong. It needs a whole new way of thinking.
That's photographer Edward Bertinsky from the film Manufactured Landscapes. Steve Paulson talked with the director, Jennifer Bikewall. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
The stereotype of photojournalists is that they're adrenaline junkies, risk takers. But I've interviewed a bunch of them over the years, and the thing that always strikes me is their humility. And maybe that's because at the end of the day, their job is to erase themselves, to become the lens that lets us see the world in all its pain and suffering, but also in its beauty. I'm thinking of a conversation I had with photojournalist Brendan Bannon about a picture he took at the Dadaab refugee camp in Kenya. And this was during a drought. And in the picture, the landscape and the sky are bleached white. The ground is just dust. And in the middle, there is one single vibrant shout of color. It's a little girl sitting in the branches of a dead tree.
The girl in the tree was sitting at the edge of a long line of people waiting to be registered. There were close to 1,000 people arriving each day at the time that I was there photographing, and arriving after these grueling walks through the desert and kind of perilous border crossings. For me, that girl sitting in the tree alone at the edge was just doing what kids do. She was playing, she was trying to get a better view of what was going on, just observing everything. And, you know, as an observer myself, it's a way of, I guess, putting yourself into the picture. I'm wondering what I'm looking at the same time she's wondering what she's looking at. Finding the beauty, finding the wonder in a situation like that is paying homage to the fact that daily life goes on in a tragedy. I think a lot of how I approach a situation like that was developed because I spent years taking care of my mom, who had multiple cirrhosis. And from the outside, people would look at that situation and think that she was somebody who was suffering. But with this front row seat that I had to her struggle, I saw somebody that was surviving every day first. And there was an incredible beauty and power to that. And I take that, I think, as a challenge when I go out into these situations to see what is it that people are doing in their lives. And while they may be in the midst of a tragedy, they're also continuing to try to live their lives. They're continuing to try to be strong for each other. They're continuing to love the people that they love. They're mourning maybe the people that they lost. They're doing everything they can to maintain their dignity. And there is something, I think, that's fundamentally beautiful. It's funny, sometimes I find myself pulling the camera away from my eye when I see something that's really remarkable, because I don't want it to be there. I want to be able to see and confirm that I'm seeing it with my own two eyes. It's kind of a double check. I'll take the camera away, I'll look, and then I'll be reminded that I'm there to photograph and put the camera back up and take the shot if it's still happening. I mean, ultimately, I think that as a photographer and as a journalist, there's a principle that I share with students when I'm teaching, and it's to tell people that we're the least important people in the room, that in the end, we're not there to tell our own stories. We're there to tell somebody else's and tell it as truthfully as we can.
Photojournalist Brendan Bannon has documented refugee crises, epidemics, drought, poverty, and hope throughout Africa. To see that picture, go to our website at ttbook.org. Taking pictures of war is a complicated business for everyone, photographers and viewers. Us. The late philosopher Susan Sontag thought a lot about that, about whether looking at photos of war makes us recoil from violence or whether something else is going on. She wrote a classic book on the subject. It's called Regarding the Pain of Others. And in this interview, she told Steve Paulson that the history of war photography is full of contradictions.
All war photography is susceptible, available to being used for organizing against war. But I don't think it has to have that impact at all, because I think in certain contexts you see these images as, look at the terrible things the enemy is doing to us. We must fight even harder to repel the enemy. I think to a Palestinian, looking at images of the destruction of the center of the refugee camp in Jenin, these are not anti-war images. These are images which promote militancy.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you point out that many of the classic war photographs over the decades were actually staged. I mean, going back to Matthew Brady during the Civil War, a lot of those pictures of dead bodies were – the bodies were rearranged to make them look especially graphic, I guess you could say. And other classic photos were staged as well. The American soldiers planting the flag at Iwo Jima, that was a recreation of an actual event.
Well, you know, I think that the understanding of photography almost from the beginning was that it was something that was posed. To begin with, it was because exposure time was quite lengthy by our standards. It could be up to 15 seconds in certain light conditions, as long as a minute. So it was understood that photographs were posed. And I think the notion that photographs should be of an absolutely unguarded moment, as if the photographer is a spy catching something, an event or situation or person, unaware of being observed, is a much later notion. You mentioned the iconic World War II photograph of the raising of the flag in Iwo Jima. Now, of course, there was a raising of the flag at Iwo Jima. It happened in the morning. The photographer, who was an army photographer, had people perform the event again, soldiers, later in the afternoon, with a much bigger flag. That's the interesting detail. If you actually look at the flag in that famous picture, it does seem awfully big for soldiers to be carrying around. And, of course, it makes a much handsomer picture.
Does that bother you? I mean, doesn't that seem wrong to do something
like
that?
Oh, I think it bothers everybody. But the standard that a picture should not be tampered with, I think that's been slow in evolving. Now I think people would be extremely intolerant of that kind of thing. But there are two pivotal moments, I think, in the history of war photography. One is the Spanish Civil War, where for the first time a war was covered by photojournalists, most famously Robert Capa, who had cameras that were portable. Before that, photography was basically the camera on a tripod. So the photographer was not going into the thick of battle. But once the portable Leica and film that could shoot 36 images before reloading was developed, you had the photographer going into battle and producing images which really set the standard for what war photography could be. That was, on the whole, very partisan photography. The famous images from the Spanish Civil War are all from photojournalists who were on one side, namely the Republican side. They were against the fascist rebellion led by Franco, which did, in fact, triumph. In the Vietnam War, I think that was a second turning point, where, again, most all of the photography was taken by partisan people who sympathized with the sufferings of the Vietnamese and of the American soldiers, and they were not for the war. And a lesson was learned from the Vietnam War by governments making war that one must not let the photojournalists have free rein.
And you don't see that anymore. I mean, in the first Persian Gulf War, there are very few pictures of actual combat.
Actually, the model for that was in an even earlier war, a small war waged by Prime Minister Thatcher. And when the British Expeditionary Force was dispatched to Argentina to recapture some islands off Argentina that the British owned, Thatcher essentially forbade journalistic coverage or controlled it so thoroughly that there were virtually no battle scenes or scenes of the carnage and the deaths that were caused in that war.
Now, you mentioned Vietnam, and the ethics get really complicated. And for instance, there's a famous picture, I think it was in 1968, of a South Vietnamese policeman shooting a Viet Cong suspect. And the picture is, I mean, it's unforgettable. It's the moment of death as the bullet is entering the body. But apparently that was, in a sense, staged as well. I mean, that policeman waited for the journalist to assemble before he executed this guy.
That's right. And people often say, well, why doesn't the photographer intervene? You know, photographers are very often accused of being voyeurs, of photographing something when perhaps they could have prevented it from happening. I think that that's a very unfair accusation, because in these situations, I don't think the photographer could prevent the event. Maybe I shouldn't say photographers. The public for war photography obviously particularly prizes and finds particularly memorable photographs taken at the moment of death. It's like a whole separate category of war photographs. There's a fabulous example, totally memorable. It's three photographs taken by Tyler Hicks, a marvelous photojournalist who covered the war in Afghanistan in late 2001 for the New York Times. And he shows in three photographs, a kind of triptych, the murder of a captured Taliban soldier, a wounded soldier, actually, who's been dragged out of a ditch. He's already wounded, very severely wounded, and is then butchered by advancing Northern Alliance soldiers. And it's absolutely horrible images to look at. Now, what do you feel when you look at that? One's feelings are so complicated, Steve, because, I mean, who of us is sympathetic to the Taliban? How can we be sympathetic to the Taliban? It's one of the most atrocious and despotic movements in modern history.
But there is another side to
this.
It's a human being. It's horrible. I don't think anyone can look at those kinds of pictures without feeling horror. But yet, on the other hand, there is a certain thrill. I mean, it's the dirty little secret about what we're talking about. There's a kind of voyeuristic appeal to seeing some of the carnage at times, not always, but at times. It's the reason why, you know, we often slow down as we're driving by a car wreck to try to catch a glimpse of what happened.
It's absolutely true that there is a voyeuristic impulse in many people, in most people, and they will slow down to look at the car wreck and then say, wasn't that terrible? We are attracted in some way to these images. The basis on which we're attracted is rather complicated. Maybe it's that we want to experience that we are safe. You see, if I can go back to the idea of the whole book regarding the pain of others, what does the title mean? It means we are safe, and we are looking at something happening to other people, but we're not there. We're here. We're here looking at a magazine or a newspaper. We're in front of our television sets. We're looking at images on our computer. And the terrible things are happening somewhere else. So why do we want to look at them? First of all, we think we ought to look at them, maybe. We have an obligation to look at them, to know what the world is really like. Maybe we have a particular identification with this struggle or a particular interest in it. Maybe we're testing ourselves to see if we really can look at terrible things, like a kind of ordeal. But I think in all of these experiences, something is happening, which I think is real at the same time, very questionable, that it's there and it's not here, and if you're just looking at it, you're not responsible.
In a sense, it removes us from the suffering. And I don't want to overplay this, but we can perhaps feel a little more virtuous by going through the pain of looking at these, but yet also in the back of our minds we know that's not us. I mean, we're safe. We're innocent.
One, it's not happening to us, and two, we're not doing it. Now, the second assertion may be a little questionable. I mean, if your country has gone to war with another country, do you have a responsibility to oppose that war? I think that the images tend to make us feel passive, but I don't think, as I used to think, that they necessarily desensitize us. I think they only desensitize us when we're told this is an age-old conflict, there's absolutely nothing to be done about it, it's hopeless. Then I think you say, oh, that again, and you switch the channel. But if you have been told that something can happen, something can be different, if you have another political context, I think these images can be very mobilizing, and I don't think you get used to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, I think we tend to feel these days that given the reach of the modern media, that we see everything. We see all the horrors, but that's actually not true. I mean, we don't see
I think the world,
the worst of it. Going back to the September 11th attacks, we saw repeatedly the plane smashing into the World Trade Center. we saw almost no images of dead bodies. And you know, clearly they were there, but people chose not to show those.
Yes, there was a great deal of largely self-censorship, which of course is the most powerful form of censorship, of the images of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. There are virtually no images of the destruction of the Pentagon and of the people who were killed there. And there were a lot of photographs that were taken, this is well known, of very gruesome things at the World Trade Center. And what was the reason that the people who control the media gave about this? This isn't helpful. Or something you hear very often, this is not in good taste. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm very suspicious when people talk about good taste as a reason for not showing something. It's felt to be unpatriotic. It's felt to be demoralizing. There are all sorts of reasons.
Well, the other reason that's often given is it would be disrespectful to the families of the dead, that somehow it would be dishonoring the memory.
Yes, but that's because Americans have the rather obscene habit of thinking that American lives are worth more than anybody else's lives, and American lives have an entirely different value than other people's lives. We don't have a problem about showing foreign dead. We have a problem showing American dead. Mm.
And it is true that you almost never see the face of a dead American.
Well, those Civil War photographs that were taken by the Brady team on the battlefields of Antietam and Gettysburg did show faces, and they were extremely shocking. They were really breaking a taboo. But by and large, notions of disrespect to survivors is a reason often given that we don't show bad things that happen to Americans. But we have no problem about showing bad things that happen to people abroad, particularly people in Asia or Africa, as if those people didn't have relatives and as if those people couldn't confront those images. I think, again, of the soldier, the Taliban soldier who's butchered in the Tyler Hicks pictures. I don't think it's unlikely that his family saw those images. People are online in Afghanistan. They have access to these images, but we don't think about that. Americans tend not to think about other people being human beings with families in the same way that we think about ourselves.
The late Susan Sontag. She was talking about her now classic book, Regarding the Pain of Others, with Steve Paulson. Thanks for listening today. I hope, as always, that you heard something that mattered to you, or maybe something you'd like to share. Remember, there's always more in our podcast feed. You can find us on iTunes or wherever else you download your favorite podcasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio, based in Madison. Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour. He had help from Raymond Tongakar, Craig Ely, Doug Gordon, and John Merfeld. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. The great Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. We'll be back next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.